who to love, who to trust, and what to sacrifice. On today's Between the Covers, a conversation with Susan DeFreitas, the author of Hot Season. That is coming right up here on The Boo. Hey, thanks KBOO members for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
On Monday, February 13th at 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline will be hosting a Valentine's Day special. We will be reading your Valentine's shoutouts to your friends and loved ones. So whether you are locked up or your loved one is, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Attention, Prison Pipeline. An email is kboopc@gmail.com. Then tune in and have your loved one tune in on Monday, February 13th at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read live.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is writer and editor Susan DeFreitas. DeFreitas' fiction, nonfiction, and poetry have appeared in The Utney Reader, The Nervous Breakdown, Story Magazine, and Southwestern American Literature, among others. She's the author of the 2014 chapbook Pyrophytic and is a graduate of the Pacific University MFA program in creative writing. DeFreitas is also an editor who works at Indigo Editing and Publications and as a consultant and book coach for fiction writers seeking help with plot, structure, and characterization. She gives lectures and teaches workshops on such topics as on writing the natural world, on how to use the techniques from fiction when writing one's memoir, on strategies for editing, and on how to market one's book once it is finished. Susan DeFreitas is here today on Between the Covers to talk about her new novel, Hot Season, just out from Harvard Square Editions. Literary critic Jonathan Russell Clark, in his description of Hot Season, says, imagine a novel by Donna Tartt, but edited by Gordon Lish, calling the book a wonderful mix of literary thoughtfulness and instinctual storytelling gifts. Oregon Book Award winning Carrie Luna says, Hot Season explores the charged terrain where the youthful search for identity meets environmental activism and the romantic illicit lure for direct action. And author Monica Drake calls Hot Season a beautiful book that asks the crucial questions, is it worse to destroy a dam or to destroy a river? Which is to say, how do we live our conscience on a crowded, corrupted planet? DeFreitas has captured what it means to be coming of age in a tangle of love, politics, and environmental degradation. Welcome to Between the Covers, Susan DeFreitas.
Thanks for having me.
So you've spoken about how Hot Season, while a novel, is inspired by real events from your life, and in fact that all of your writing, even when you're writing speculative fiction, comes from real life experiences for you. So knowing this, it is interesting to revisit the publisher's copy for Hot Season, which begins this way. An outlaw activist on the run, a pipeline set to destroy a river, and three young women who must decide who to love, who to trust, and what to sacrifice for the greater good. So I can't help but ask, what are some of the real life inspirations that led you to write Hot Season?
That's a great question. Well, I will say, first of all, that one of the big inspirations for this book and the two that follow it, in what I'm thinking of as the Green River Chronicles, are the deaths of three kind of larger-than-life characters who were real people who were part of my community where I lived in Prescott, Arizona. And so in this first book, Hot Season, that real life person was a man by the name of Bill Rogers. And he is the inspiration for the fictional character, Dyson Lathe. Bill was indeed an outlaw activist on the run. Although I would say almost no one who knew him before the FBI raided the activist center that he had started in town, knew that he wasn't, in fact, on the run. we just knew him as a kind of an inspiring local figure who was really very much involved with a variety of local environmental struggles, among them the struggle to save the Verde River, which is the last free-flowing river in the state of Arizona. And so the three books of the Green River Chronicles, they're all about that struggle to save that river, which continues to this day. Mm-hmm. So I would say that was the main inspiration, the real-life inspiration for the fictional events. But you know, another real-life inspiration was the house that the book is set in, that's shared by the three roommates, Rel, Katie, and Jenna. That was definitely based on my house on Campbell Street in Prescott. And though some of the dynamics between the characters were not, in fact, based on my time that I spent in college in Prescott, but rather on the years that I spent later on in the aughts, wherein I myself was not in college, but I had younger roommates who were. So I kind of got to participate vicariously in their various college dramas as an older person. And I think that perspective is reflected in the point of view of Rel, who is the main character.
Hmm. Well, given that you have a strong connection to the book has a strong connection to your college experience in Arizona, and that there's a person you actually knew who deeply informs the outlaw activist. Tell us a little bit about the decision-making process to write this as fiction versus nonfiction, and if any craft elements come out of how you made that decision, if it was a difficult one or not.
I really think that I write fiction because I have a hard time sticking to timelines, the way that they actually occurred, and details the way they actually occurred. And also this, I like to write about rumor, real rumors, as if they were facts, right? Because I have this sense that what you believe to be true or what might be true, it is as much a part of your actual experience of life as anything else, right? So, for instance, you know, the idea that there are, you know, there are undercover FBI agents enrolled in college classes. That was brought to my attention by one of these younger roommates that I had when I myself was not in college, but she was. And it was sort of her, you know, speculation about various rather attractive characters in school and whether they had the potential to be one of these kind of false characters, you know. I loved that. I loved the storytelling potentials of it. I didn't really care if it was exactly true, right? Although I found out later that there is some truth to that. So I love conflating the true and the imagined true and the possible together. Yeah. Because I think all of that is really part of our lived experience as human beings. So I've always taken real things and told tall tales about them, you know, really ever since I was a kid. So it's really much more difficult for me to write memoir or nonfiction because that means tracking down the details. Oh, was that thing that somebody said, was that actually true, or did I just believe it to be true, or did it not actually happen at the same time? I just remember it that way. I love how fiction allows us to create something artful out of what we remember or imagined, as if it all has kind of a similar level of truthfulness.
Well, that's a great answer, and it brings up the question for me: did you have to obscure the identities of anybody in particular, and what techniques you use to do that, or did you have to ask anybody's permission to create a character in the book that maybe they would recognize?
You know, nobody in this book is based on one person. They're all composite characters, right? So in that way, you know, I think if you happen to know any of the people who were involved in a composite character, you will recognize them. But I also believe that anybody who knows well enough to see the influences in the characters will also recognize that they're not any single person, right? Mm-hmm. So for that reason, I didn't feel the need to ask permission. Now, I skewed a little closer to the an actual single person with the character Dyson Lathe. But I felt a little easier doing that because I, although he was part of my social circle, I did not know him that well. And again, part of what I took the liberty of doing here was to treat all the rumors about him as if they were true, right? Without verifying, oh, did X, Y, or Z actually happen? So I did a little bit of research on him beyond what I knew, but I also took the liberty of conflating rumor. And with such a larger-than-life character, there's a lot of rumor to work with.
Yeah. So. Well, it was interesting reading it because it made me, even though it took place in Arizona, it made me remember a lot of things about Portland in the 90s mm-hmm. around environmental activism pre-9/11. Mm-hmm. Since environmentalists or direct action environmentalists have been charged under terrorism laws since 9/11, we don't really see the same sort of thing that you depict in the book, and also that I remember in Portland when groups like the Environmental Liberation Front or Cascadia Forest Alliance actually had storefronts. You could walk in, even though they were like, the leaders were hunted by the FBI, no one knew who the leaders were. So there would just be the contact person in the storefront for ELF that would, that everybody knew, probably like a Bill Dyson character, mm-hmm. But nobody knew how involved or how not involved they were. And it all seems strangely quaint now that mm-hmm. it was so out in the open. You could go to Cascadia Forest Alliance and support tree sitters that were that are now probably people who would end up spending many years in jail if they were to do the same thing from 10 years before.
Yeah, it's very interesting, you know. And this book really is set at a moment, you know, post 9/11 where the laws that had been passed to offer government agencies a kind of more sweeping powers to combat terrorism were being used to target domestic activists, right? Particularly those employing direct action tactics, and sometimes, of course, those going beyond direct action to illegal action, right? Expressly direct illegal action, politically motivated crimes of property, I think is the term, also known as monkey wrenching, right? So yeah, you know, this book, it is based in the Southwest and has a strong sense of place in the Southwest, but it's also very much based in the Northwest, right? Because Bill Rogers, the real-life activist who inspired the character of Dyson Lathe, was part of a group of extreme activists based out of Eugene, right, which was a hotbed of such of environmental activism in the late 90s. I believe there was actually the mayor of Eugene put out a call for help to the federal government, calling his city, you know, the U.S. capital of anarchy or something mm-hmm. along those lines, right? So there was really kind of a moment based around, in large part, trying to save some of the last old growth, right, from logging companies. And of course, Spotted Owl and all. There's a lot of stuff going on in the Northwest, right? You know, there's, yes, Bill Rogers went to school at Prescott College, which is also the school that I attended. And but he came to the Northwest, right? And that is where he really became an activist, right? And there's a wonderful article about kind of all of this storied pieces of Western environmental activist history. It's a kind of a long form article from Rolling Stone called "The Rise and Fall of the Eco-Radical Underground," right? And it talks about the group that Bill was part of. They were called The Family. They were responsible for $45 million worth of damage to like all sorts of, I mean, meatpacking factories, logging company headquarters, any kind of corporation that they deemed to be destructive to the natural world, they really took on. But, you know, as it kind of points out toward the end of that article, not only was it the anti-terrorism laws that really started to come down super heavy on folks taking these sort of extreme measures, it also, the results did not have the kind of lasting impacts that many of those involved in these type of actions envisioned, right? The largest action of them all, the burning of a ski resort outside of Vail, you know, insurance paid for it, right? And in some cases, you know, the logging company headquarters were just built back bigger, right? And in so doing, you know, not only had the end result not been achieved, the environmental movement as a whole had been demonized, right? Therefore, in some people's minds, justifying hardline action against them, right? So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't just that this sort of thing has gone out of fashion, or that you know, fascism has kind of come down against it, but rather that it proved less effective than those who were involved with it certainly hoped for.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to author Susan DeFreitas about her first novel, Hot Season. It's interesting how, if we look at environmental activism today, how much it's resonating with Hot Season, in the sense that we have a pipeline protest in your book, and we have obviously the Dakota Access Pipeline that's going on now in North Dakota, and also these issues of infiltration of the FBI within these activist groups, and questions about surveillance and in general and in the United States. We were talking before the show started, you and I, about the rise of activist literature. So I'd love to hear you maybe speaking a little bit about your perception of whether Hot Season's taking part in a cultural moment in terms of a new wave of art and literature coming out now.
Yeah, well, it's really, I have to say, kind of a little surprising to me. It also pleases me. But at the point when I wrote this book, I feel like nobody knew what to make of it, you know? And a lot of people were really not sure what I was trying to do, right? It wasn't like, oh, yeah, this is part of this particular, you know, thread or genre or emerging, you know, subject matter in literary fiction. And so, you know, of course, I had heard of Jonathan Franzen's Purity. But to me, the kind of world that I'm writing from and the kind of world that an author like Franzen is writing from are just not only on opposite sides of the country, they're like really worlds away from each other, right? So it really did not occur to me that there would be any connection there. But, you know, Megan Burbank, the books editor of The Mercury, who was kind enough this week to review Hot Season favorably, you know, in a Twitter conversation we were having, she was saying, you know, not only did she not quite care for Jonathan Franzen's take on activist literature via Purity, she also didn't quite care for Nell Zink's take on it in Nicotine, you know. I remember a recent Harper's article about Nell Zink's work, and the title of which is "Are You Kidding?" Right? And so there's a little bit of a sense there of like, oh, are you just poking fun of at people, or like, where do you mean this? Do you not? Are these your politics? Are these just, is this just a style? Is this just a sort of humor? And you know, in that conversation with Megan, I pointed out, you know, it's very challenging to write politically oriented fiction that succeeds as art, right? I remember a lovely interview you did with George Saunders, right, where you're talking a little bit of like, oh, how do your political ideals work into your fiction? He said, oh, they're like shy animals, right? You have to pretend you're not interested in them, which I think is a wonderful quote. But I personally really feel like you should know where the author's heart is coming from. You should know where the author is from. You should know where the author's heart is. You should know where the author is coming from. And that does not preclude achieving, hopefully, any of the many layers of complexity with regard to character that is the hallmark of literary fiction, you know. And I think a really good example of that is Carrie Luna's book, The Revolution of Every Day, right? It succeeds as literary fiction in so many ways, and yet you can really tell where the author's heart is. You can tell what her ideals are. You can tell where she stands, you know. And it occurred to me on the way over here that it is a somewhat revolutionary thing to do, to simply foreground the lives of people who are relatively at the fringes of society, and shine a spotlight on them with saying, you know, through fiction, saying these characters are worthy of the type of examination that only literary fiction regularly does, right? So there's something achieved simply by the framing, right? But then beyond that, I think, what are the powerful emotions aroused by this work? I think it's not just enough to make fun of the foibles of the left, you know? And I mean, there's plenty to make fun of, you right. know? But I really think you got to throw your hat in the ring for what you believe, you know, and where you stand, especially in times such as this, you know? And I think a fabulous example in recent literature, again, speaking to this kind of trend of activist literary fiction, Sunil Yapa's Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist, you know, another book that you can, it achieves this kind of kaleidoscopic layering of perspective, not unlike Colin McCann's wonderful book. I'm trying to recall the name. I know Colin is one of Sunil's mentors. Let the Great World Spin, right? There's this kaleidoscopic layering of POV and perspective. Beautiful literary fiction, right? Arouses strong emotions. Takes many sides, right? That book takes the point of view of both the police officers assigned to police the WTA protests and those involved in the protests. But again, you can feel where the author's heart is. You can feel where he stands, and that's what I strive to do.
Well, given that you're a teacher of writing as well as a writer, and you're discussing really well the danger of perhaps not being earnest enough of too much irony when portraying these issues. But when you're dealing with political subjects like environmentalism and surveillance and questions of philosophy around how to engage direct action or otherwise, do you have advice for writers with regards to conveying political thought within the framework of a story without being too didactic? Or so the opposite problem of being ironic, maybe your heart is in the right place and it's clear, but you're not actually creating literature because mm-hmm. you're so invested yes. in the political ideals. Any thoughts there?
Sure. And, you know, it's like Scylla and Charybdis trying to get between those two, you know, the bleeding heart, you know, beat you over the head with my politics versus the ironic, cool, ironic distance that keeps anything from really accruing any emotion, right? Or really being moving. So, you know, between those two ideals, I think, you know, in many places it's a matter of tone. You know, I can't really say, do this, and you'll shoot right between those two perils. But humor is your friend, always, you know. In developing the voice that I wanted for Hot Season, the voice that kind of tuned in the story for me, I returned to Ed Abbey and I returned to John Nichols, because those two outlaws, literary outlaws of the Southwest, who wrote about environmental struggles. A lot of Southwest authors write about environmental struggles. It's kind of hard not to write about them if you love the Southwest. But a little humor makes that medicine go down, right? It makes that earnestness kind of slough off, right? Mm. So it gives people a place to stand who may not share all of your ideals, you know? Humor is a great universal. But I think on the other hand, you know, the shades of gray are always your friend, because in interrogating your own beliefs, you will undoubtedly find, you know, cases where they don't hold true, where if taken to extremes, they result in things that are horrifying to you. And third, you know, we can take issue, we can stand to one side, we can feel divided against somebody who is simply trying to put forward their worldview as if we should adopt it. But when you portray a character's worldview, you know, and give them the literary depth and the contradictions that make for complexity, it's harder to argue with that, mm-hmm. you know, because that's simply what somebody believes, you know. And, you know, there are many things that people, characters in novels believe that we do not, you know, and yet we love them, you know, and we want to see how they navigate the world, where their heart is, and how their point of view shifts and changes over time. So again, that movement of the character arc as it moves through a book is a big key to that as well.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to writer and editor Susan DeFreitas about her latest book, Hot Season. Well, I'd like to quote something you've said before on this topic, because you end in something that I'm curious about. You say, "I think we're quite wary of any talk of meaning in fiction, but to my mind, if the events of the story and the character's inner issues don't align in a meaningful way, it isn't a story, it's just a sequence of events." And though this approach is unusual for academic creative writing programs, I've found a lot of validation for it in the emerging body of brain science associated with reading fiction. Can you talk to us about the brain science you're referring to? It piqued my interest. If you know of anything off the top of your head.
Oh, sure, absolutely. So, I think the person who has really done the most work to articulate this, both to gather together the research from the emerging body of neuroscience associated with reading and writing fiction, as well as the practices to put it to use, is a woman named Lisa Cron. She wrote the book Wired for Story, which is kind of the brain science book. And then her new book is called Story Genius, which is kind of her, you know, maybe not patented, but very much a proprietary system for how for the way that she coaches clients. And she is both a book coach and a screenwriting consultant, right? So number one, I love that because MFA world and screenwriting world, in my experience, they speak very different language. And they're both talking about story, but they speak in very different terms, right? And there are things that I love about each of those schools of thought about story, you know? I love that the MFA world, the kind of literary fiction approach to teaching creative writing and storytelling is super open-ended, right? Because my feeling is that the novel can take so many forms, some of which are still undreamt of, right? That those who teach creative writing at the graduate level, they don't want to kick themselves later by saying, hey, kid, this is the way it works. You got to fit inside this box, or, you know, you're not, what you will have written will not be a novel, right? Novel means new, right? So it's always changing all the time. However, I found myself rather frustrated in graduate school by statements like, oh, I don't think, I love this story, but I don't think it's found its aboutness yet, you know? Or, well, you know, you have to just keep rewriting that story until you find the voice for it. Then you'll have the story. And a wonderful kind of strong voice that has risen somewhat in opposition to that school of teaching creative writing comes from Benjamin Percy. There's a wonderful book of essays out called Thrill Me, which is all on the craft of writing. And they're based largely on craft talks that he gave at Pacific University, of which I'm a graduate. And he leans on story. He leans on action. He leans on drama, you know, actually having a plot, creating suspense. He pulls a lot from movies, from the screenwriting world in making the type of statements that he does. And I found those craft talks very refreshing during my time at Pacific. And I recommend that book, absolutely. But it wasn't until I studied some of the screenwriting approach, some of Robert McKee's book of story. And, you know, so screenwriting can be super prescriptive, right? You know, there has to be that rising action. They have these different acts. They have, you know, right down to the beat, you know. And Robert McKee's so prescriptive to the point where, you know, he recommends that in every scene, your main character, one character starts with more power than the other, and by the end of the scene, those positions are reversed, right? Things going well to things going badly. Things going badly to things going well. I love how prescriptive that is because, you know, I found when I put that to work in my scenes, like, wow, that really got some things moving, right? But at the same time, isn't art so much bigger than that, right? I'm not going to write a novel based on the Save the Cat beat sheet, right? Which is like, once you learn that form and you watch movies, you will see the same things happen at the same point throughout a movie. It's amazing how widely adopted that form is. But so what is this brain science? The brain science that Lisa Kron has kind of pulled together basically says, like, you know, in the study of creative writing, we're often told, well, your character has to want something. Kurt Vonnegut says your character has to want something, even if it's as simple as a glass of water. Well, Lisa kind of articulates why that is, right? She says if you don't know what the character wants, it's like watching football with the sound turned off and you don't know the rules, right? So, you know, that person took this action, they kicked the ball, right? Half of the crowd stood up and cheered, right? The other half looked kind of glum, you know? Now they're moving back to this point. It's like, if you don't know what people want, you can't read it. You can't, and moreover, you can't feel it, right? So that's just one of the things that she has kind of, to my mind, she takes a lot of the kind of aphorisms that were taught in creative writing and tells us kind of why in terms of the brain science. So I've kind of wandered around. This is huge territory to cover. I'll kind of try to do my best. There is this idea that when we, again, coming out of the neuroscience, that when we put on, when we read fiction, we put on the point of view of the point of view character. We essentially become that person, right? And we run when we read about somebody drinking a glass of water, the same part of our brain lights up as if we were actually doing it, right? It is a kind of virtual reality. It is the original type of virtual reality. And interestingly enough, apparently the same thing happens when we're dreaming. So you could say that story, particularly fiction, is a means of hijacking the dream state, the dream function of the brain, right? And so when we tell creative writing students, oh, use physical details, right? Use the senses. It's all part of creating that virtual reality that actually causes us to feel like we're living it, right? So another question that comes out of the neuroscience of fiction, what is the purpose of story, right? What is the evolutionary, what is the adaptive purpose of story, right? Well, the best guess that we have at this point, that neuroscientists and others have at this point, is that story is there to prepare us for obstacles and struggles we have not yet faced, right? So in a very early example of this, you know, rather than, you know, waiting until you get mauled by a saber-toothed tiger, you could listen to a story of somebody who was almost mauled and managed to get away because they did X, Y, or Z. Now, that obviously is an example that, you know, you're listening for the useful part. You are listening for the part that can save your life, right? And so what is a story? You know, in this day and age, where our the obstacles we face are largely not saber-toothed tigers, right? They're largely not of a physical nature. They have to do with navigating the social sphere, right? And also navigating, you know, difficulty, trauma, grief, divorce, like all these things that we have to deal with in our life, right? So part of Lisa Cron's proposition is that it is through the character arc of the story that we track as readers for things that we might be able to use in terms of our own life, right? And, you know, again, that's to for things like getting through grief, you know, the death of a loved one, making it through a divorce, or navigating an extreme survival situation even, right? You know, I'm editing a story right now that actually details an extreme survival scenario. It's based on real events. Like, talk about an adaptive function, right? So the reason that that story is so seductive to us, that it penetrates the dreaming brain, it gets our attention, it makes us forget about the real people in our life who need our attention, you know, much more pressing things when we're really in a story, is because there's the promise there that something is going to be revealed to us of great value that we could then use later on in our life. And that is all through the character arc of the story. That is not through just watching the game with the sound turned off, not knowing what the rules are, right? So I feel strongly about the way character arc and plot arc can work together to create meaning.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to writer and editor Susan DeFreitas about her latest book, Hot Season. Maybe this is a good time for people to hear a little bit of the prose. Do you have a section you'd be willing to read?
I'll read to you from chapter one. The name of the chapter is Pyrophytic, And this is from the point of view of Arel. Winters in Kraftstop were generally mild, despite the altitude. That was one of the things Arel liked about her college town, the way snow was no more than a novelty, a snow globe fantasy of soft, swirling flakes that melted away the next day like a dream. But the winter of her senior year snapped hard and cold, with temps in the teens, and brought so much snow that it shut the town down. She was almost happy to go home to Pittsburgh for the holidays, where at least the roads were plowed. But her boyfriend, Trevor, was increasingly vague on the phone, and by the time New Year's rolled around, she had begun to suspect that he hadn't driven to Mendocino to see his sister the way he'd claimed, that he'd stayed in Kraftstop instead. Why? And why had he lied about it? It was clear from the moment she walked in the door. Someone had left a peachy pink windbreaker on the coat rack by the wood stove. Someone had left a jar of honeysuckle soap on the ceramic dish by the sink. Someone had been sleeping in her bed and cuddling with her cat and using her loofah to buff her butt for all she knew. That someone was Trina, a perky adventure education major with chiseled biceps. Trevor had been meaning to tell Rel about her, but he'd felt like Rel would be mad. Well, no kidding, she wanted to say, and a few choice things as well, but it was all so immature and awkward and awful that her voice never made it past the hard lump that had formed in her throat. At that point, nothing she could have said would have made a difference anyway. The happy couple was long past the love goggles stage and onto the type of passive-aggressive bickering that had taken Rel and Trevor years to achieve. What she wanted more than anything, then, was her own space. A clear, sunny space with sweeping views, where she could sit and sip her tea in the mornings. Counter space and sink space, free of Trevor's dishes. Wall space and head space, free of his reggae posters and glassware, the reek of his pot. A quiet space of her own where she could lay out the maps and cuttings associated with her senior project, which centered on those perverse plants of the Southwest that required fire to germinate. But the breakup arrived at the beginning of January, which was the wrong time of year for space in Kraftstop. Moreover, space cost the kind of money Trevor had, but she did not. So Rel was forced to take up residence in her final semester in a room the size of a shoebox in a janky old rat trap in the barrio, which, for the record, was surrounded by all manner of noise. Domestic altercations, house parties, smack-talking little 8-year-old hoods, and wholly lacking in views, unless you counted the two built-down mobile homes across the alley out back. There was a yard, at least, with space for a garden, which was something she'd wanted that Trevor had not. But the house itself was full of tacky linoleum and questionable carpet, and had been rented by students for so long that no one had any idea who half the furniture in it belonged to. Fortunately for Rel, it was also so drafty that the two freshmen who'd signed the lease were looking for a roommate in the off-season just to help them cover the heat.
You've been listening to Susan DeFreitas read from Hot Season. Susan, you've been lauded for getting the details right regarding this alternative community of fledgling activists, and I imagine part of that's your own experience at Prescott College. But you yourself also grew up in an alternative community. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and how maybe growing up in an alternative community informs the narrative of this book?
Sure. I mean, it informs almost every narrative I write, because it's just so central to my worldview. I grew up in what I call an unintentional community. It was really a group of folks who wanted to get back to the land in the late 1970s, and they were all interested in farming. They moved to West Michigan in the late 70s and early 80s and formed a food co-op, which was really like a natural foods buying co-op, because there were no Whole Foods, of course, at that time. And there wasn't even a funky little, you know, co-op grocery in West Michigan at that time. I come from a town of about 2,000 people, Hart, Michigan, which is the county seat. So that should tell you something about how rural the rest of the county is. Most of our friends lived out in really what are the boonies of a place called Ferry. And so they, you know, all these couples had kids around the same time. All of those people are really my family members. I call them my co-op cousins. A lot of them stayed where we grew up, but a number of them moved out west. And we're all still very close. Many of them are who stayed back home are raising the third generation of our co-op there. But really, in terms of how that informs my my worldview and my stance as a writer, is that I think a lot of narratives that seem somewhat fringe to folks who grew up in more mainstream circumstances are mainstream to me, right? They're very normal to me. There's something about that mainstreaming of it, that normalization of it, that is important to me. You know, even just one part of my experience growing up in such a small place, such a rural place, right? I never saw people who had lives anything like my own, my friends, or even the folks in town on TV, right? To me, TV narratives happened in cities or in the suburbs. And I remember the first time, out of kind of the chatter of adult voices droning on Charlie Brown style in the background, I remember hearing Garrison Keillor's voice on the radio. And as a kid, and realizing that he was talking about someone from a small town. He was talking about people from the country, from the Midwest, from where I was. And I think that was an experience that spoke to me. It just told me how much it could mean to people whose narratives were not typically represented to have themselves represented in art. I think the other way that growing up in this kind of back to the land community influences my fiction is that we grew up in hand-built houses, and they're very cool houses, many of them, right? Built by our parents, built in many ways through a lot of group labor on the part of our co-op. We're kind of like a hippie version of Amish that way, right? Mm. We actually had a barn raising, I remember, from when I was a kid. We would have work parties. And these houses have kind of reinforced to me, you know, there's some statement about, like, you know, the architecture of the buildings that we spend our lives in really influences the way that what we're able to think of, the way that we're able to imagine the world. And growing up in these sort of houses influenced me to believe that you could make a world, you could make the world different. You could remake the world, right? And I find that throughout various different stories, I always need to know what buildings my stories are set in. You know, what is the aesthetic created by them? So that's maybe a little not directly connected, but something I have found to be true. Now, as far as, you know, my alternative community and Prescott, I didn't just go there for college. I lived in Prescott, Arizona for 14 years, right? And I directed a community and arts festival, arts nonprofit there. I got to be the ringleader, you could say, of a huge show, you know, big cultural arts festival. And so I really got to have a sense for all these different tribes, you know, the pyro maniacs of Tucson, the underground circus culture of Denver, you know, a lot of these different performance communities based throughout the West. and a lot of them very connected to activism in their art. So all of that informs my work.
And you were in a traveling circus as well?
We called ourselves a circus. I would say we were actually much more in the vein of vaudeville.
My question about that, your experience of that, and maybe the way a couple of characters seem to hint at a lifestyle similar mm-hmm. to that, is that I know you write both realist literature and fantastical literature, mm-hmm. and I wondered if that was maybe one entry point in a book that is squarely realist to bring in the fantastic. Maybe another way to ask the same question is, were there ways in which you wanted to try to bring magic into a book that was squarely in the world that we recognize?
I always want to bring magic into the world that we recognize. And in some ways, I chafe against the constraints of realism that way. But, you know, even my speculative stories, they're always set in this world, right? So whatever you call it, wherever it the work gets shelved in a bookstore or online, I'm always working the same vein, right? Which is where the sense of magic enters the real world. And you'll see that absolutely in the circus. You know, it's kind of the bookends, right, of Hot Season. It starts with a traveling underground circus performer, and it ends with some traveler's tales told by a group called the Dead Man's Revival, which is on tour, right? And so, yeah, that circus is based out of, you know, the Black Cat, the activist community center in this book, is a center for travelers, activists, artists of all stripes, right? So, yeah, I managed to get a little magic in there through the circus, one would hope. But, you know, one of the things I really found, a lot of the stories that would later become Hot Season, I wrote during my first couple semesters at Pacific University in my MFA program. And I really, you know, it was the first time in my life where I'd really like sat down like, okay, I'm going to write realist fiction. I'm going to figure out how this is done, right? And a big part of the impulse was to my nostalgia for the high desert, which I had left, right? I wanted to master the techniques of realism to portray this place that I loved and these people that I'd loved and this struggle, which is really important to me. But I really found myself after a certain point of like working hard at this for a long time. And, you know, you're in graduate school, you're working with people who are kind of famous. You want to produce good work, right? And under these very tight time constraints, which I found very, very stressful, right? But there was a certain point where I kind of felt like it was just, fiction was just this glorified version of like what we did when we were kids with like two dolls or puppets, where it's just like, you know, you're just making these like puppets like walk to the door and now somebody's got to say something to each other and blah, blah, blah. I just found it like that is not the part that made me fall in love with fiction. And I found it the most exhausting to reproduce, right? So I really had to ask myself, well, what got you into this? What do you read for? Like, what makes it more than just actions and reactions and plot to you, you know? And so I kind of interrogated that and came up with this response, which is aesthetic, right? I like to read for what the world of a book feels like, right? And out of and again, that's part of why environments, built environments and natural environments are really important to me when I sit down to write. But when I interrogated aesthetic, what I really found was like, you know, if we're going to talk about the aesthetic that I associate with the high desert, the magic, the sense of magic that envelops a summer's night, is is really a touchstone for me, right? It's a place where the real and the imagined are, you know, occupy a same level in your depth perception, right? Where the air is somewhat the same temperature as your skin. There's this sense of like a fluidness between things that normally have a firm boundary. And animals are out at night, and people are out at night, and you can absolutely hike by the light of the moon, right? And so that environment, that underwater full moon summer's night in the high desert, was such an inspiration to me that I kind of brought that forward in a story of its own at the time, which. My poor mentor, Thisbe Nissen, who had me that semester, you know, I was throwing together dreams. I was throwing together this night hike. I was throwing together the surrealism of American flags, like absolutely everywhere you looked at the certain point in time where the book is set. But there was no plot. Right. And at that time, the characters involved in that story, I didn't know who they were or what they were doing or anything. I wrote the aesthetic first, right? And then built it down to the point where it's firmly connected to plot. It's firmly connected to character. But I learned something throughout that process. It was like that magic of aesthetic, that comes first for me. And I can build my castles in the air down to the ground, but I have to start up there.
If you've been enjoying today's conversation with Susan DeFreitas, you can go to kboo.fm/betweenthecovers later this afternoon and hear the last 30 minutes of our conversation. You've been listening to Between the Covers. We've been talking today to Susan DeFreitas, the author of Hot Season. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM, Hood River, 104.3 FM, Philomath. This is your community radio station, listener-supported and non-commercial. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And Portland 5, presenting an evening with Spanish classical guitarist Pablo Sáenz Villegas. Born and raised in La Rioja, Spain, Pablo Villegas performs compositions that echo his homeland's musical heritage. January 20th at the Newmark Theater in Portland. Tickets and information are available at portland5.com. Good afternoon and welcome to the World Beat Connection. I'm your host, DJ Charlie, and I'll be with you until 2 p.m. this afternoon, bringing you the music of Africa and the African diaspora in the Caribbean. And we're getting back to normal weather-wise. Good old Portland weather in the 40s. We're able to get around. And I hope you're enjoying your day, getting out, getting rid of that cabin fever, getting back to normal. And we're going to spend some great tracks this afternoon here on the World Beat Connection. And we're going to start with some energy from the UK. His name is Bim Sherman. Bim Sherman, part of the U Sound system. From an album called Tribulation, Down and Jam Down, 1974 to 1979. A track called World Go Round. And then we're going to follow that with a track by Screwdriver, called If You Follow. So I hope you follow the World Beat Connection this afternoon.